mapping the pathways, like the pain pathway, light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, putting that together to try and understand what's better for the individual who's sitting in front of you, what's more likely to work, is a really desirable goal. For a start, it's cheap. I mean, it doesn't cost anything to ask someone, are you sensitive to light? You don't have to have a fancy computer to do that. You can have a wonderful time on an app doing it, but you know what I mean? It's a sort of information that you could use everywhere in the world and make therapy better. We haven't got there yet, but that this pathway analysis and linking that into individual symptoms, that's certainly one of my goals in the next period of time in the research we do.
Even today, experts don't know exactly how and why a migraine attack occurs. Researchers often debate the evidence behind different theories, which has led to the development of new treatments like triptans, CGRP monoclonal antibodies, and GPANs. In this interview, we're going to explore different frameworks that may help explain how a migraine attack occurs. We're also going to consider how these theories may explain why some treatments are more effective than others. Before we jump in, it's important to remember that frameworks are a simple way to describe incredibly complex mechanisms in the body. After all, if this was simple, we'd already know exactly what happens and how. Dr. Peter Goadsby joins us today to help us simplify some of these complex mechanisms so you don't have to be a scientist to understand. Dr. Goadsby, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
To start off with, can you describe what pathology or the pathophysiology means for migraine?
There are two words that are bandied around in this conversation quite a lot. One is pathogenesis, and the other one is pathophysiology. Now, pathogenesis talks about where the disorder and where the attacks come from, what starts them, if you like, causality. And pathophysiology, strictly, is about what happens during the attack once you've got it. So pathogenesis, why do you have migraine and someone else doesn't? Pathophysiology, what hurts? Why do you have nausea? Why are you sensitive to light?
What is a migraine pathway?
Migraine pathways are concepts almost of how the brain, how connections in the brain and with nerves in the head are engaged or turned on during migraine. They're explanations that we use to try and build a frame to understand what's going on, and a frame that we can test, and a frame that we can then begin to develop new therapies and new approaches to management.
Could the different pathways that are activated in migraine also have implications for treatment?
I think yes, if we understood all of the pathways and we understood all of the connections and all the chemicals involved, and we understood how they produced individual symptoms, that would be fantastic. You could have a person who's got a lot of nausea. And if you understood exactly what was going on, you could target therapy at that in comparison to someone who has, for example, dreadful light sensitivity and has to wear sunglasses all the time. You could be targeting at that. Now, there's probably overlap, but I think we know enough to say that those pathways have differences. So the better we get at this, the better we'll get at therapy.
So let's talk about some of the theory behind some potential pathways, maybe some symptoms that may be associated, and if there are potential treatments. So, and I appreciate that a lot of these pathways don't necessarily explain the full picture, but it'd be interesting to understand some of the theory behind it as much as possible in plain English. So the trigeminal pathway is often mentioned in migraine. Can you talk about what this is?
The trigeminal pathway that's so often referred to in migraine is the quintessential pain pathway, if I could say it that way. And it refers to the nerves that supply sensation to the head, the front of the head, the trigeminal nerve, and the back of the head, the occipital nerve. That also supply, branches of which, parts of it, supply the structures inside the skull. And they all go to the same group of nerve cells, both the front and the back, go to the same group of nerve cells within the brain, and that system of lining them up, that pathway, is what generally speaking people are referring to when they're talking about the trigeminal pathway.
And what kind of symptoms can that express in patients?
We think that's why most people say, when they say the word headache, they generally hold their head up the top here. They don't hold this bit of their head or this bit. They call that the face. Okay. They'll hold it up here. You go anywhere, you go to an old church and see a gargoyle, and it's holding it up here because this is the first division. And when you've got migraine, for example, or cluster headache, then the activation of the pathway is saying to you, oh, there's something going on out here. Whereas actually in the main for the pain, it doesn't have to be much going on out there because the perception is coming from inside. There's this interesting overlap. So as you start to understand something like the first division, you start to understand and its pathway, you can understand why pain can feel a bit diffuse, it can move around, because this pathway is meant to tell you something bad is happening and you need to do something about it. It's not meant to tell you take your skull off and dig around, because that's just not a thing.
So if you have pain expressed in the second and third division, so around that sort of upper jaw area, maybe the sinuses, and then in the lower sort of area of the jaw around the teeth, with a migraine attack, that might inform the trigeminal activation of that pathway?
Yes, and that's precisely why many patients with migraine will get pain here in the second division. Okay, and they'll think sinus. And they'll end up seeing sinus doctors and so forth. And it'll take a while for the penny to drop that it's migraine. It's important that the localization can be a bit of a red herring. So you need to know that these pathways overlap. And that's something that doctors learn about, and particularly neurologists we're pretty obsessed with nerve pathways. So it's an area of comfort and interest.
And what implications does that have for treatment if you identify with this trigeminal pathway?
Well, at the moment I'd say it has none at some level, because all of the activation of the trigeminal system tells you is that there's a problem in the head. Well, you already knew that when you came to the doctor. That wasn't a terribly revealing exercise. I think that, your introduction sets out the goal. What we've done so far is a reasonable job of coming up with a description of migraine that works pretty much everywhere in the world, and that if you apply it in clinical studies or clinical trials, you'll get pretty much the same result pretty much everywhere in the world. So you can study something and then it's useful to pretty much everyone who's got migraine, to a proportion of them. What we haven't done is the next level. What people what physicians and researchers would call, another fancy word, endophenotyping, meaning getting a history like you've got throbbing, you've got nausea, you've got light sensitivity, you've got sound sensitivity, you've got smell sensitivity. But not everyone has all of those. And the detail of that is within the phenotype is what you have. Using these pathways and mapping the pathways, like the pain pathway, light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, putting that together to try and understand what's better for the individual who's sitting in front of you, what's more likely to work, is a really desirable goal. For a start, it's cheap. I mean, it doesn't cost anything to ask someone, are you sensitive to light? You don't have to have a fancy computer to do that. You can have a wonderful time on an app doing it, but you know what I mean? It's the sort of information that you could use everywhere in the world and make therapy better. We haven't got there yet, but this pathway analysis and linking that into individual symptoms, that's certainly one of my goals in the next period of time in the research we do.
I think it's still helpful, like even just knowing that about that information about the trigeminal pathway makes you realize that if you're going to take sinus headache or sinus treatments or something for your eyes or something for your jaw, but it's actually just a reflection of that trigeminal pathway, that that those treatments aren't going to work. You need something specific to migraine.
Imagine for a moment that you've got pain in the head here or over here. And when that activates, you also get some eye watering and some nasal stuffiness. And it feels a bit uncomfortable. People will think, oh, sinus. Okay. And that if you didn't ask any other questions about light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, what's the pain like, what happens with mood, all the other questions, you might think, oh, pain, sniffliness, that's sinus. It's clear that a large proportion of migraine patients will get misdiagnosed because that rest of the depth of history doesn't get given. And what they're simply telling the doctor is about a pathway that we know about and we know exactly why. And as we've been able to explain it to physicians, I think it's having just not knowledge is having a useful effect in the mask. You just have to ask the next couple of questions and you'll realize whether you're going down the sinus road or going down the migraine road. So it's an example of a pathway. If you know about it and you ask a few questions about it, or if you're a patient and you're getting these symptoms, ask yourself, do you get other symptoms? Do you get the light sensitivity set? Do you get other symptoms? And if you do, maybe you don't have a sinus problem. Maybe you've actually got a migraine problem and you've got a cranial autonomic activation.
Serotonin is something that we hear a lot about in the pathophysiology of migraine. Can you tell us about the potential serotonin pathway, the symptoms that might be expressed, and maybe the implication for treatments if there are treatments that specifically target serotonin?
Yeah, the serotonin pathway is such, that means a couple of things. Once you start talking about a chemical pathway, can have several meanings, but let's take two big meanings. One meaning is, where's the serotonin coming from? The biochemical pathway. How is it synthesized? How is it made? That's a pathway. And the other place is, where is it used? What are the anatomical pathways? What nerves use serotonin? So you can manipulate the serotonin biochemistry, how it's made, how it's cooked, so to speak. Or you can try and manipulate it in a way that manipulates the nerve pathways that are involved. In migraine, probably when we think about serotonin pathway, we're talking about the pathways that use serotonin. Whereas, give you an example, in mood disorder, in depression, when you talk about serotonin, the medicines at work change the way the serotonin is taken back up into nerves. So it's a little bit more about the cooking than it is about the pathway. I mean, it's a rough distinction, but it's useful because, you know, you can throw a word, you can throw a phrase around and it'll mean something totally different. And people think you're in the same place. And before you know it, you're off in a very different place. So the serotonin pathway, the implication in migraine is the way serotonin interacts with certain nerve pathways. So serotonin interacts with the trigeminal pathway. The serotonin can turn trigeminal neurons off. And serotonin can interact with pathways that process light and sound within the brain. And the way that all works, the other sort of part of the triangle, if you want, are what are called the serotonin receptors. It's another thing that people talk about a lot in the migraine world. And the receptor is the place where the serotonin acts.
If we respond to triptans, does that also mean we might respond to maybe an antidepressant because it's activating in a similar way?
Yes. Well, the simple answer to that, unfortunately, is no. For a few reasons that we understand, and I guess a lot of reasons that we don't. So another thing says serotonin is involved in emesis, in throwing up, in vomiting. There are the serotonin 3 receptor was studied in considerable detail to develop antiemetics, anti-nausea drugs for cancer chemotherapy, and we use it sometimes these drugs in migraine. So that there are other things that serotonin does. Because of the 14 receptors, it's a messy story. So the receptor profile that seems important just in mood is serotonin. If you look at the drugs that are used that overlap with depression, tricyclic antidepressants because of their structure, they actually affect serotonin, noradrenaline and dopamine. They're what pharmacologists call dirty because they do a number of things, which of course they're clean when you take them, but messy from a professional perspective. So it's And the literature is reasonably clear that the pure serotonin drugs are actually not useful in migraine. So it's not, there's more going on in migraine in terms of pathway, in terms of migraine prevention pathophysiology than acute attacks. And certainly if you change serotonin levels, the serotonin can affect any one of the receptors that are in the brain. So that gets even messier. So there's no correlation of that. And I think that's because serotonin is such a, you might say, promiscuous transmitter. It's happy to talk to 14 receptors, interact with them indeed.
So you mentioned serotonin's role on dopamine. Can you tell us about the role that dopamine plays, you know, its pathway in the context of migraine, what symptoms that it might sort of affect, and if there's any potential treatments as a result of its involvement?
So you can see that if a person yawns, using a diary system, electronic, couldn't go back and change, more than 90% of the time, if they have that, they'll go and have a migraine attack. Okay. So what do we know about yawning? You can activate dopamine receptors in migraine patients and get them to yawn, whereas if you activate a dopamine receptor in a non-migraine patient, they don't yawn. Interesting enough, you can even do that in experimental animals. So yawning seems to have a dopamine component to it. Now, what's emerged from the imaging, some wonderful imaging work, we've been interested in this, Anna May has done some incredible work imaging, and you have to really, let me give a shout out to the patients who get involved in this, the patients that he's been studying who will have their brain imaging done every day for a month, 30 days, suffer an attack, not treat it, just really provide something to the community. And the areas, one of the areas we've shown, the work we've done and that Arna's shown, is activation in a region that would overlap with an area called the hypothalamus. Won't surprise you to learn that there would, that among other things, this area has dopamine. So there's a, what I think is exciting at this level is that you can just get into one thing, just yawning. And then you can narrow down what chemical might be involved. You start to think about what brain areas are involved. There are five dopamine receptors and some variants. Which ones are going to be important? That kind of opens up a whole new way of thinking about that symptom. Now, a holy grail from my perspective is treatments that you could take before the pain even comes. Why wait for the pain? That doesn't sound like a good idea at all. If we could understand this earliest phase, this premonitory phase, when the attack is sort of building up, and we could stop it in its tracks, you wouldn't have to have the pain. Our research is really quite focused at the moment on the early premonitory phase for this various for this specific reason.
GABA is something that comes up as well in the description of migraine. Can you tell us what this is, potential symptoms that we might experience as a result of GABA, and if there's any implication for treatment?
Yeah, so as you say, GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid to its friends, is mentioned. GABA is the most important inhibitory transmitter in the nervous system. What that means is the transmitter that turns things off, GABA. There are receptors that, unsurprisingly, it's a chemical, so there are GABA pathways, there are GABA nerves, there are GABA receptors, just the same thing as I said for serotonin. What interacts with that, those of you who've used benzodiazepines, like diazepam, it acts on the GABA receptor at a benzodiazepine site. They're sedative, as you well know. At the moment, the GABA, while it's clear that migraine has a turning on and turning off, some things are turned off and some things are turned on. That's not rocket science to say that. And so it's not rocket science to think that the turning on things have a certain chemical involved. Glutamate would be one of them. And the turning off things have got some chemicals involved. GABA must be one of them. I don't think we've gotten to a point where we understand enough about how to narrowly target that. Because if you broadly target GABA transmission, you're going to turn a lot of things off that you don't want to turn off. And those people who take benzodiazepines and get and have sedation effects will know exactly where I'm going with that. I think that's much further away than understanding dopamine because it's so ubiquitous. There's so much GABA in the brain that if you start playing up with it, you could be pretty sure that the first couple of passes of that are going to be associated with a lot of side effects. You know, and it's the migraine patients have got bad enough. They're producing new drugs with new side effects. That's not a thing. That's not very helpful.
If people have done some of the history and looked at some of the theories behind migraine, you'll hear about this vascular theory of migraine or the vascular pathway. Can you tell us about this theory?
The vascular theory of migraine is conceptually that the migraine pain is generated by an enlargement of blood vessels, which as they enlarge, stretch, change the nerves that are innervating. So as you stretch something out, it gets uncomfortable, so to speak. And that's broadly speaking. So the term vasodilation as a manifestation, the concept is that if you constrict the vessel, you stop that dilation, the pain will go away. Now, a sub-hypothesis of that is around migraine aura, the idea that the jagged lines that will move across the visual field are because there's a turning on and then there's a turning off of the brain, a constriction. And after that constriction associated with loss of vision, you get a dilation, an increase, and that's what causes the pain. That's the, I'm not trying to do a disservice to the vascular people. I think that's broadly the idea. I think that I mentioned earlier on the diTANs. The fact that you can take a drug that has no vascular effect, full stop, new paragraph, and you can stop a migraine attack tells you that the vascular theories, it's a difficult thing to keep a hold on.
One of the things I've noticed with this vascular theory is that when I exercise, particularly when I do vigorous exercise, which I really enjoy and I find is a prophylaxis for migraine, like a preventative, I have these veins in the side of my head that are definitely dilated, like enlarged and throbbing, yet no pain. But when I feel myself having a migraine attack, those veins feel exactly the same. And so for me, that's kind of how I'm thinking about how, you know, this vascular theory, yes, you can have dilation, but unless there's the sensitivity involved, you know, for me, it's not painful.
Exactly. Just as everyone sitting watching this who's not having migraine is throbbing. Heart, all the vessels in my head, I'm very happy that they're open and they're throbbing. And everyone without a migraine is throbbing. And when migraine people are sitting without migraine, they're throbbing, guaranteed, because that's the way it works. Boom, boom. Now, you don't need... All you need to do is change how you perceive the throbbing to have a problem. You don't actually need to change the throbbing. I think the soundest way of thinking about this, when I think about it, my favorite way of thinking about it is when I think about light sensitivity. It's crystal clear that the amount of light you actually get from the sun, the photons that hit your retina on a migraine day and a non-migraine day, they're the same. So the only game in town for light sensitivity and sound and smells is that the brain misinterprets the signal that it gets. And I think there's a thing called Occam's razor, the idea that you take the simplest explanation. So it's my view that the substantial part of what's going on is misperception of normality, dysfunction in the way the brain is supposed to ignore light and sound and ignore the fact that you throb, because it would send us crazy if we could feel throbbing all the time. And the system was not designed for that.
Inflammation is mentioned in migraine, and you know, people may have heard migraine described as a neuroinflammatory disorder. Can you tell us about how that plays a role or its pathway in migraine and potential symptoms?
I very often hear migraine described as a neuroinflammatory disorder. Again, like as with the vascular side, that's an idea, not a proven thing in my view at all. The idea is that there's a reaction in the covering of the brain, the meninges, that is sterile rather than infective. So if you have bacteria, bacterial meningitis. You'll get an inflammation, that is cells that come in to try and scoop up the bacteria, you might say, and break it down. The concept of inflammation and migraine is that those reactions are occurring without an inflammation. So it's called a sterile, no infection, inflammation. I don't see that there's ever been, there's any definitively convincing evidence that occurs. I don't think of migraine as a neuroinflammatory problem. I think it's simply a neural issue.
Well, you'd simply take anti-inflammatories, wouldn't you, if you thought that migraine was primarily an inflammatory disorder?
You might start that way by taking anti-inflammatories, but I'm guessing that there are people watching this who've taken anti-inflammatories and they didn't make a blind bit of difference to their migraine, because if anti-inflammatory sorted everything out, I'm not sure that there'd be a lot of shows like this on. So I'm very lukewarm on that concept. You know, drugs like naproxen, for example, they're useful for some people. There's no doubt about that. But just as they're useful for some people, you know, if you say naproxen and ibuprofen and you say to the people listening, you all should respond to that, don't think we were crazy, because I'll wager that there are many people who listen to this who don't respond to those one little bit. There are other things going on. Just as nothing works for everybody, but as you know, things that don't, if something was the answer, if it was the, you know, if it was like diabetes, you know, and you just had to understand what the blood glucose was, if you knew what that was, that would be a thing. It would be the single thing, but it's not like that in migraine.
And I think that's why it's so challenging, because you know, triptans are an effective treatment and they're helpful for probably the majority of people with migraine. But I've never responded to a triptan, unfortunately. But I do respond to naproxen and anti-inflammatories. It's not a perfect response, but it's a better response than I get from triptans. But that's not, like, I'm an exception to probably the majority there, and trying to figure out why, like, you know, is it because my migraines are more inflammatory or activating on that pathway? So I think this discussion is helpful to understand the potential mechanism of action and the implications for treatment.
And we're going to see that evolve further with the GPANs, the CGRP receptor antagonists, and the DITANs, the serotonin 1F receptor agonists. There'll be people who'll say exactly what you just said, but they'll say it with different things. And as we develop more of these medicines, and we try to nail down what it is about X response, you know, the GPANT responder versus the DITAN responder, we'll get some insights into the disorder. And that's a kind of iterative process. As you understand the disorder better, you get better understanding how to use it. The other thing to say is migraine's not static. So I see patients who've responded perfectly well to a medicine, and then it doesn't work. It doesn't work. A very frustrating situation. I mean, what is that about? Because the pathways are not static. They're changing and they're evolving. And we need to understand that longitudinal dimension of this as well.
Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with the audience?
I would say, if you're talking about pathways and pathophysiology and pathogenesis and all the things that we've been talking about, firstly, the first thing I'd say is that we don't understand everything about migraine. Anyone who tells you they understand everything has really completely lost the plot. It's not the case. Anyone who tells you that research in migraine is not useful has also lost the plot, because the research is delivering therapies, and it's not delivering to everybody, but understanding is delivering therapies. And the third thing is that understanding the basis of something delivers something that people can hold their hands on. It's fantastic that I think that I can explain to you why your eye might water. That is just knowledge that's important. So I think that there'll be migraine people watching this who think that who've gone nowhere over years. And I've liked to often say that even if everything's hopeless, things are actually changing on a pretty regular basis. So don't give up. There are people like, you know, research people babbling in our own, with our own terminology, trying to do something useful, and things will improve. Every day you lose to migraine is a day you shouldn't lose. So let's try and And, you know, let's join hands and really demand more resource so that your migraine gets understood the way it should be, so you can have all of the life that you want.
Dr. Peter Goadsby, thank you so much for your time on the Migraine World Summit. And thank you for all the research, work, and passion you've invested into this condition for, you know, on behalf of patients worldwide. It's been a pleasure interviewing you.